Welcome to the Visions of a Better World podcast. We're continuing our discussion now with Professor Franklin Obing Odum from the University of Helsinki, Dr. Bonuego from the University of Vescula, and Dr. Faith Mukwesha from the University of Turku. So we were previously discussing the Global South and the current situation and the great challenges that we're facing collectively on this planet, but now we're thinking about talking a little bit about the future and the possibilities of the Global South. So Max will continue the discussion now.
Yeah, so we thought that we would first take a look ahead, let's say into the year 2050, for instance. So what would an ideal world look for the Global South then to you? And you can comment on everything from community levels to economic systems and beyond. What would an ideal world look like? Would you like to start, Franklin?
An ideal world would be inclusive, accentuating prosperity, autonomy, and sustainability. Bridging the wealth gap is fundamental for that ideal, but so is keeping that wealth gap closed. The challenge is overcoming those forces that seek to keep the wealth gap open, either by inaction, by aggression, by division, or by diversion. That, I think, is a key challenge. But of course, related to what this vision is also what action various institutions and persons can take towards this ideal. And on that, my own view is that trying to bridge the gap by playing catch up is unsustainable. But redistribution by reparations and restitution is more sustainable. Domesticating capital by commoning the land, I think, is fundamental or vital to attaining this ideal. And if land is already privatized, then instituting land value taxation can common the land. On taxing labor or workers would complete this triumvirate of capital, land, and labor. Clearly, no one institution or person can take all of these actions. It's a bit like a musical band. Everyone has got a part to play.
Bon, what about your thoughts on this question topic?
What would be the ideal world for the Global South? 2050, for me, that's too soon. In 15 years' time, and I have a critical realist and pragmatic kind of approach in answering that problem. But we should unashamedly embrace utopia and a global vision for the future. By that time, that year 2050, I hope that the world will be more genuinely polycentric, whereby countries in the Global South would have more policy space, autonomy, and freedoms to chart their own future in terms of economic planning, defining and mobilizing their own land, as Franklin mentioned, resources. So basically, hoping that the so-called nation-building processes or the decolonization processes promised and envisioned for the Global South would have been more advanced. I don't see things in terms of the end term, but in terms of processes. And that process has different tendencies, and it could move to different directions. So that ideal world should have the conditions for our classic aspiration, human flourishing. But I'm really worried about wars and the real threat of wars as we speak. Hence, my ideal world would be a peaceful world. I am for peace because peace is a precondition for every good vision that we aspire and dream of for the economy, for politics, for the environment, for our individual dreams, as what Astrid mentioned. And towards that, and because I problematize also insecurities brought about by capitalism, I envision a more caring world, also a more caring Global South countries and governments. And part of that would be the rediscovery of the welfare state.
Faith, what about your thoughts on this question and topic?
I think I agree with all the points that have been raised by Frank and by Bon, but I would like to add on that my vision of the world is a world which is pluriverse, a world that allows the multiplicity of knowledge systems to coexist. I think Walter Minolo has explained that very well. We have many decolonial thinkers. We have been talking about the plurifaciality of knowledge, Ndovu Gacheni, Ramon Crosswell, Senju Hira, Obiama Namaka, and all these African and global thinkers. We have been talking about a plurifacial world where we don't have one dominating way of knowing the world. So I see that world is a flourishing one. I also have this utopia, like Martin Luther King talked about, a world that Martin Luther King said that a world where his children would be judged by their character, not by their skin color. As a mother, I've seen the pain of children just suffering and being treated so bad just because of their skin color. So I envision a world where the difference becomes a norm, where there's no one who is so bothered whether with any form of difference, it just is normal. What is important is what we are, your character and what we are trying to achieve. So I envision that as a perfect world. I also envision a world where the Eurocentric Global North understands that there are different ways of organizing society and they should be respected. I think Bon talked about culture a lot. Understanding that what the Euro-America cultural values propagate for their societies, they are not the norm for everybody. For example, in Obiama Nemeka talks about how Igbo society is organized according to seniority. It's not organized according to gender. In all Africa, gender is not the organizing principle of society. Gender is imposed by colonialism. So I envision a world where the West does not invent any form of cultural processes or practices, and then they just go around forcing everybody that now this is what everybody has to do. They have to learn to respect. I envision a world where the West, the Euro-America can live well with the rest of the world, respecting their own ways of organizing society. And culture is dynamic. It always changes. If something is good, people will quickly evolve and copy what is good they take. They don't have to be forced that you have to do this because this is what we are doing in the West. So I would like to envision a world where there is a world of reciprocity, a world of Ubuntu relations. So far, they say the credo of humanity is Africa. The research that has been there has been saying Africa is the credo of humanity. That's what we know so far. But I think as we continue research, it might change. So if Africa is the credo of humanity, I would really want to look at a world where we reclaim Ubuntu as our guiding philosophy, understanding that we are who we are in relation to others, the humans, the environment, and objects So we are not, we have to create a perfect utopia. Feminists, black feminists have been very crucial in shaping the futuristic utopia, that way we can live as equal and with respect, with care, with compassion, and with love. Toni Morrison also talks about the world where we don't have to focus to talk about racism. Because she says this talk about racism takes a lot from us and those who experience it. So we'd like a world where we talk about invention, about care, about progress, and we don't really have to talk about all these other things. And I think a world that is governed by love, not by domination, dehumanization, extractivism, toxic masculinity, and all these other things that happen. We want a world that is relating based on love. I think we have many black feminists who have talked about love as a human ingrained. In Ubuntu African philosophy, we say that love is natural, but hatred is learned. Mm. You have to learn to hate. But love is a very natural. That's why as small babies, we all smile and we love each other. We have to learn to hate. So I think he also, Nelson Mandela, also was very central in talking about the notion of learning to hate. And he also advocated for Ubuntu. Desmond Tutu also advocated for Ubuntu. South Africa went through a very violent time, but when it became independent, the Africans were advocating for Ubuntu-centered relations. But it has not been successful up to now. Why? Because Ubuntu works when you all embrace it. When the other one doesn't embrace Ubuntu practices and principles, it doesn't work. So the former people who were benefiting from apartheid did not embrace Ubuntu, even though Mandela and Desmond Tutu worked so hard to push for Ubuntu and used Ubuntu as the framing of forgiveness and so forth. Mm. The other side did not accept, did not embrace it. So I envision a world where the Eurocentric will embrace Ubuntu, because I think the global majority already embraces Ubuntu in many different forms. I think the Chinese have yin yang, balance, so they already embrace it in their different, in their philosophy. So it is there in many philosophies. So I think Africa can gift the world Ubuntu.
Mm. Yeah, sounds really good. Sounds really good. What then about, because we know that everything is global today, as we already just discussed. So we are all connected to each other, even more today than before. So how would then the rest of the world benefit from a thriving global south? How would the whole world benefit from a thriving global south? Frankly, what are your thoughts on this?
It's widely claimed that a thriving global south is win-win. It's good for everyone. But I ask, how so? If privilege and underdevelopment benefit whiter, wealthier societies, then how is depriving them in their interest? Even if research shows that a more inclusive world is a more sustainable and a more prosperous one, it's my view that the case for a thriving global South should never be framed in terms of others benefiting. We have a right to thrive.
Bon, what about your thoughts on this question?
I agree with Franklin, and I've also said that in other venues that I don't want to romanticize also the global South. As I mentioned in my earlier analysis, it has been a victim of historical process of maldevelopment, including the cultures have been maldeveloped. Politics, you have terrible dictators, autocrats in the global South. And then the way, as I mentioned, capitalism is also evolving has also impacted the mentalities and behavior of people, because more and more people have become very insecure. But having said that, we need to address all these problems that led to the global South's maldevelopment. And the guilt falls on the former colonial masters from the global north. So a thriving global south means that it has been cured of all the diseases of European colonization, American imperialism, British imperialism. And that would be a condition that is based on the principle of global justice and fairness and humanity. And once we have attained that, so what I'm saying here is that it's a process to attain, not at the very moment, because there are just so many complicated. It's much more complex than our dreams would like to have. So it's a step-by-step process. But in the end, what's good for the Global South, of course, is good for the Global North as well and for the whole of humanity.
Faith, what about your thoughts on this question?
Yeah, I think the Global South is the majority. So if the Global South is the majority of the of this world, then if it's thriving, the minority are going to benefit from whatever the global majority will be producing. I can give an example of Africa as a continent. They say by 2050, 85% of the working force, young people, will be from Africa. So if Africa is supported in terms of education, so that they are given the right skills, they are given they are given access to education, they are given ability to be innovative and so forth without a lot of interference. They are given access to tap into their indigenous knowledge systems. There's not much interference on their culture, and the culture can develop and so forth. I think they are bound to contribute a lot if it's the 85% of the working force is going to be from there by 2050, as the African Union is saying, and also OECD. OECD, the United Nations, came up with a report last year saying that 15 to 64 years old, 85% of the global working force will be from there. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to invest in education. And then also there's been the United Nations decade of people of African descent. Many countries have not done anything. The whole idea was to reflect on the past and what has happened in Africa and the global African, and how to come up with the restitution and that Frank has been talking about. But many countries have not been participating. So I think it is in the responsibility of the global community, the Euro-America, to participate. Even Finland, I think there was only one event in Finland about the people of African descent. I think we need this to happen so that there's a lot of decolonial reflexivity, so that we can be able to map a better inclusive way forward that can enable what Frank and Bonnie have been talking about. Yeah, I think I'll stop here for now.
Okay, yeah. Then what then would be the consequences of a future where the challenges regarding the global south are not solved? What would such a world look like? What's at stake here? Franklin, would you like to start?
That's right. The signs and times are clearly concerning and sobering, as all of us here on the panel have said. But they are not Kafkaesque. Modeling by the Institute of Security Studies based in South Africa shows that even if Africa continues to travel on the current trajectory, the percentage of poor people in Africa will decline from 37% to 21%. And if most things are done right, which according to the ISS means that there's aggressive economic growth, that percentage decreases even further to 6% by 2043. So if there is no utopia or even real utopia, the other scenario is not necessarily apocalypse or dystopia. Of course, in both scenarios, the ecological crisis worsen. Little is said about social stratification and whether inequality is entrenched. Probably would get even more entrenched. For me, a different path is needed. But change is never a final act. Even destinations evolve. I think what is tonic is what Osibisa, the Pan-African band, once sang. We are going, the road will be muddy and rough, but we will get there.
Bon, your thoughts on this topic?
Yeah, I said that what's good for the global south can also be good for the global north and the whole of humanity. And the same goes, you know, what's bad for the for the global south would even be worse for the global north, and of course the much worse for the humanity. Now we also observe that with Trump logic of cutting down development cooperation, development aid. So that means, for instance, efforts on health issues, like projects for HIV AIDS. Beneficiaries are about 20 million people. And we know that this kind of diseases, epidemics, can lead to pandemic again. And if it's pandemic, it's a global phenomenon and everybody's affected. The zoonotic diseases, we just came from the COVID-19 pandemic. We should not forget that. And then here in the global north, the problem of politicians are mass migration and immigration. So if the climate and ecological problems in the global south are not addressed, there are no stopping from people from fleeing to safer grounds, and that's here. And the same thing for those who are also fleeing conditions of privations and underdevelopment. White Europeans should not forget also the reason why they have migrated to America. Faith already mentioned about it. You know, when capitalism in America needed more laborers, one of the first settlers would be the white Europeans, and they also fled, you know, the Irish, the Germans, Scandinavians, they fled conditions of impoverishment and maldevelopment in and underdevelopment in Europe. That's why they went to the US, and others who are suffering political persecution, those communities that they have bombed, they will also, because of survival. That's why one of my advocacy here in Finland is that, I'm in solidarity with fellow immigrants. Hashtag, we work for Finland. I support that, of course. But I think I have to call out my fellow immigrants to have a sense of consistency and solidarity. Because the difference of immigrants like us, Franklin, Faith, and me, why we are here is that we are immigrants by choice. I mean, in terms of our education, despite the flaws and inefficiencies and violence in the Philippines, where I come from, in Ghana, where Franklin is from, and in Zimbabwe, where Faith is from, we still have functioning institutions and culture. There is really no serious civil war where the asylum seekers and the refugees are here. So there are tendencies among expats, the highly educated, to just say that you need us here. Finland needs us here. Europe needs us here. The right-wing political parties would say to them, okay, go back to your home country and help it. But they should have a sense of solidarity to the asylum seekers and the refugees, because, as I mentioned, we expats, educated, coming from countries that are inefficient And with all the flaws, we still have functioning systems. But those who are real asylum seekers and refugees, they are fleeing conditions of war for survival. The same thing that would happen if all the conflicts and wars and genocides are not solved in the global south.
Faith, your thoughts on this topic?
Like Frank and Bon said, I agree with them. I would like to add that in a world where all these problems are not solved, I think there's a saying that that happened in 2022 from the EU chief, Joseph Borrell, when he said that Europe is a garden and the rest of the world is a jungle. So I don't know if you have a small garden that is surrounded by jungle, and you are contributing in this other, all these other places to be jungles, how long we can survive, because we know nature. Nature does, the jungle will creep into the, according to Borrell, the Borrell was saying that the jungle is going to creep into the garden, and Europe has a responsibility to protect the garden. So I would like to say that inside we critiqued a lot, and I would like to acknowledge that he apologized later on for this statement. But it's an important statement that he said. It's a way of thinking that we have, because if Europe is a garden, and then we can ask, well, how did it become a garden? And then we can ask, how long is it Europe going to sustain this garden? Because it was this garden was built by taking everything from everywhere. But when where we have been taking everything, you can't take anymore, then how is the Europe, this garden, going to survive? It will not survive. So I think it will be a very, it is in the interest of everyone to have a peaceful world where we all coexist with the equal distribution of resources and pay. And I think what is really important is what we didn't really talk about is that Europe must have a concept of negotiating in good faith and pay for resources that they are extracting. For example, wherever there's a new resource, there's war, or this conflict. The main reason is that they don't want to pay for the resources, they just want to take. So if we could pay the resources, for example, Africa is the richest in terms of resources. If we could pay, and then that those countries have got money, and then they could also be supported to develop good governance institutions and so forth, and democracy, then everyone benefits. Those resources they benefit everybody. But I think like what is happening now is that even the resources that are extracted everywhere are benefiting the 1% of the world. So that's why now we have the populism, because the 1% is everything. So even here in Europe, Euro-America, there's going to be no peace. We can see already that there is a crisis of populism in far right, because the resources are being extracted. There is no equal distribution, 1% on everything. So everybody is going to suffer eventually. I think I would like to conclude by this writer called Kwe Amar, who wrote the novel "The Beautiful Ones Are Not Yet Born." The Beautiful Ones Are Not Yet Born talks a lot about misgovernance and all that Bon was talking about, which happens in Africa as well, and the focus was Africa. We have to make sure that we create conditions for the beautiful ones to be born, who can create a better coexisting world that is harmonious and peaceful world.
Okay, so we have now discussed the issues and future visions as well, but let's focus now for a longer while on the possible solutions. How could we get today to a better future in the coming decades and years? So what are some promising alternative or currently developed models for economic and societal transformation, or even radical ideas that could prioritize local needs and autonomy in the global south and make the global south thrive?
I would say something briefly about this. I'd earlier given some examples about industrial downstreaming and diversification. But now I'd like to focus on common in the land. Much has been said about migration and what potentially explains the movement across borders. I suggest that common in the land is one way of addressing any crisis of migration. I give the example of the Balinese people in Indonesia. Balinese land is generally considered a commons. That also means that ancestors are buried on the land. Generations are buried in the same land. Balinese people's identities are tied to the land. They have responsibilities to the land. They live collectively on the land. When Balinese people are married, the new member of the family goes to the land. Balinese people rarely move en masse anywhere else. They live on their land. That land creates economic opportunities. That land is used for various economic, ecological, and social activities. My central point here is that commoning the land is a major institutional step towards addressing various political economic tensions, among which is what is sometimes called the migration crisis. So this is one possible tangible local approach with major regional, national, and possibly global consequences.
Bon, what about your thoughts on these possible solutions?
Alternative models for economic transformation and radical ideas that I've been witnessing at the moment. I think it's what would be promising are the existing, the real existing resistances against the domineering ethos and paradigms of Eurocentrism, imperialism, and capitalism. Faith already mentioned that we see tendencies and movements against Eurocentrism. It's called decolonialism or more local forms of organizing. So the resistance and alternatives to imperialism, we see sense of anti-imperialist coalitions, South-South solidarity. The Global South can be both disempowering and an empowering concept. The Global South or developing countries concept can be used by the Global North to perpetuate their superiority. But the Global South concept can also be used as an empowering concept, you know, for countries and societies who suffered, who had a common history of colonialism. And we also see that, there was a Bandung conference in Indonesia in 1955, and then we are moving to the 80th anniversary celebration of the Bandung conference. So this is an anti-imperialist front. We are also seeing the Group of 77 in terms of trade preferences when they advocate that. What you mentioned as well, the guests that you had in Global Visions before, movements coming from the Global South, anti-imperialists, those for debt jubilee. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a lot of odious debts borrowed by dictators and also just unfair and inhumane. You know, the reparations that Franklin are also being talking about, those are real existing resistances. And the one of the most vocal, as we know it, the call for climate justice, yeah, all the lost damages, the reparations. And then recently, if you might heard, G20, under the presidency of Indonesia, actually said to the European Union and the US and Russia, and including China, hey, there are other more important agenda for humanity. So don't be so obsessed about your wars. So these are, you know, these anti-Eurocentric, anti-American exceptionalism, anti-imperialist, these are real models. And also, I must follow up on what Franklin mentioned about the commoning of the land, because Franklin is also one of the most important theorists about the commons. So it's an anti-capitalist kind of perspective and vision. So it's looking forward to a decommodified and non-materialistic, non-monetarized future and ways of organizing. In the different regions of the Global South, the promising ones, as we know, would be many in Latin America, the progressive movements. There are also proliferation of the ideas on agroecology, like alternative farming systems, lands cooperatively or commonly owned, and then tendencies about like the Buen Vivir, or Pachamama, the Mother Earth, or about the good life, like rediscovering a harmonious relationship between human beings and nature. So those are also being advocated. As scholars, it's called what Faith mentioned, the pluriverse. So there are different worlds in our own world. We are already documenting different initiatives and also introducing different concepts and terminologies within this notion of the pluriverse. Because before, if you may recall, one of the most popular motto of the World Social Forum was the another world is possible and necessary. Now, the battle cry of the Global South and those who are anti-imperialist, anti-Eurocentrism, and anti-capitalist would be another world already exists. So because it's not enough to just talk about alternatives and alternative models, we really have to make alternatives visible and tangible.
Faith, what about your thoughts on the possible solutions?
Yes, I think to add on that, I think all these social movements that are happening that Bones mentioned would also benefit a lot if some of the progressives in the global north would connect, would be participate actively as equals with these other movements. Because usually what happens is that they come with the intention of the superiority complex to teach these other organizations how to build their movements, and then there's conflict. So if they can be humility and the many good people in the who are not amongst the 1%, it's only 1% in the global north that is benefiting from the global wealth. So all this 99%, they should just work together with everybody else for the benefit of all humanity. Because what is happening is that to refuse this hierarchy that has been created such that others think that, okay, and made to strive, to want to belong to the 1%, which is also a difficult situation for all of us to go and to be made to strive that it's possible. All of you 99% of the world, you can become like us 1%. I think we just have to become conscious, to open our consciousness and mobilize each other, and to also have people who are seeing the illusion to connect with each other and work together. And refuse all these categories that are constantly created so that we focus on those categories. But to refuse and just see each other as humans, and that's it, we are humans, and refuse whatever categories is created. Whether it's, if you look at the number of categories that are created, I followed even the feminist movement, you just get flabbergasted, wonder who is even influencing this creation of so many categories. And so, and those categories then create conflicts. So we just need to refuse to the categories, and we come together as the 99%. the 99% who want to have the 1% share equally with everybody. And if we reach at that level, I think we can be able to envision a new world. But if we are not very proactive, we can see the 1% is already working so hard to create using this artificial intelligence to create control. Say control surveillance, and a lot of things are going to come with that control surveillance. We might end up not even able to do many things. So I think the 99% in the Euro America must work together with the global majority, and not accept the lie that okay, we are a garden. The garden is for 1%. The majority are not in this whatever flourishing garden. They are in Europe, but there's a flourishing garden, but some many of them have come weeds that are constantly weeded off. So I think we just need to think beyond the, for example, race that has been weaponized, so that people in the global north cannot work together with others, because this is the weapon of race. And then we just also have to reject class. This idea that there's an upper class and a lower class and everyone. If we reject that, then we'll be able to work with all these movements that are working so hard. And I'm so proud, because if we look at what the global South, for example, Africa and even Latin America have done to fight against colonialism and achieved it, it means the 1% cannot really enslave everybody. I think decolonizing the mind is also about freedom to think, really freedom to think as a being without control. But we have to go through even at individual level to decolonize our minds, so that we can be liberated to think freely. And then we can be able to cooperate with others, with all these movements that have been talked about.
So we have now discussed quite high-flying themes and the future and stuff like this and big ideas. But what about the next best ideas that we could implement now? So if you could propose one action each for governments, international organizations and individuals to improve the future of the Global South, what would those actions be? The next steps?
Yeah, governments, international organizations, individuals. What are doable and practicable to be done now? For governments, change economic policy goal and strategy from obsession with growth, as what Franklin calls it, the growth mania, and also the obsession to competitiveness. You hear the European Union, the European Commission, and then also in Finland, just all competitiveness, be competitive. Yeah. That's just the economic goal. And for me, that should be considered a problem and causing further problems. So shift the economic goal from growth obsession and competitiveness to the goals of full employment and basic incomes. Because once you have an economic policy that would like to have full employment, those who would like to work can have work. So it would also entail a big government. So if they cannot be absorbed in the private sector, the government can create jobs for people. And then that already established, you know, the economic security of people. And I think because one of the biggest problems, and also the reasons for racism, is insecurity. And we should not forget the material basis of insecurity, which is economic. That's why others would say that, well, they are stealing jobs from us. They are also just consuming our welfare state. I mean, like, they are just welfare immigrants. So establish that condition. And then once people have job security, it also addresses the social pathologies associated with being unemployed and being underemployed. You know, there is just tremendous psychology of being unemployed. We pretty understand that here in Finland. So the goal of full employment. And then once you are employ, the other would say that one, it's still based on productivity obsession. No, and it's bad for the environment. No, you can create jobs that is also green. Yeah. And then why I would like to include basic incomes is that, you have to change the value system of the society. Not everyone should be productivity obsessed. The economy cannot absorb and provide jobs for everyone, but then provide them opportunities for self-cultivation, yeah, to be creative work. Now you are, because of these competitive pressures, you are not anymore allowed to be a philosopher or a gardener or just a poet. Yeah, you have to be exploitable to the labor market. So that's why basic incomes is important, because that would give citizens an opportunity also to flourish as a human being, you know, the way he or she would like to lead a good life. And that economic conditions can go far enough. And then for international organizations, they really have to transform. If not, we can work with existing institutions, but really massive reform that should be done. So they should be converted into institutions for global governance. We really need that. So these global governance institutions can create conditions for world peace and then create conditions for a fair world economy in terms of trading. And then the global governance institutions, because of issues related to not just production, but also to finance and technology, these are global tools and phenomena. They have to do forms of regulation, but they have to regulate for the common good. And for the individuals, just basically back to school and household virtues and values taught to us. Just be caring and kind. And then believe also in the notion of collective action. So students always ask me, how can I bring about change? You can bring about change and make meaningful changes in the society if you belong to an organization. Yeah, you cannot do it individually. Yeah, it should be a collective action. So belong to an organization, associate yourself with as much soulmate as possible. And then lastly, Ubuntu has been the common theme, especially of my African colleagues here, Faith and Franklin. But in a way that is understandable in the global north as well, in every culture, in English word, in Finland as well, it's just called the golden rule. It's also Ubuntu. Ubuntu, for me, as I said, is the view that there is an I in you and a you and I. So golden rule is that do not do unto others what you don't want others to do unto you. And I think that's the way to conclude my wish for fellow human beings and individual.
Yeah, I think I would also agree with all this that has been said. I would like to add an activist from India. Her name is Vandana Shiva. She's an environmental activist. But Vandana Shiva, she has been doing a lot of activism against commercial farming and the monopoly on seeds. Why she thought that, she said that all research that she has done has shown that you don't improve the majority of people's lives by having commercial farms. People improve their lives when they have got their own piece of land and they can farm and they can have their cows and so forth. I know in the context of maybe, for example, Finland, we might not think that is feasible because of our environment. But in Africa, the weather is good every time, for example, and even in Latin America. So people have got good weather. They stay in their place, on their small piece of land. They farm. it's a very sustainable if they can be supported. But the problem now is that there's been a lot of push of commercial farming, which is destroying the smallholder farms and habitats. So I think it is one of the most important aspect in the sense of land that Frank was talking about as well. Because, for example, in Zimbabwe, people have not been working 90%. But what has made the people survive? Otherwise, no one knows. Otherwise, if it wasn't that everyone has their piece of land, we would know about Zimbabwe, all of us, from starvation. But we don't know it about starvation because everyone has their own what? Piece of land. They farm, they have beans, they have vegetables, they have fruits, they have everything on that small piece of land, and they sustain themselves, even though 90% are not working.
Mm.
They are sustaining themselves. So through empowerment, I don't know, I have an issue with this emphasis on employment, because which is also a model in the West, that of also the part of the capitalist system, everyone must be part of a machine, must be employed, and a desire to be employed. I don't think that everyone should have focus on being employed. People should be allowed to be able to sustain their lives, to have capacity to have sustainable lives and work if you want. But if we create situations like here, that you have to be working, you have to have credit rating, you have to, all this whole machinery of capitalist machinery, it is very enslaving. And many people, I think, are realizing that, no, you become a slave of the capitalist system machine if you really have to work. And you can work. Some people end up with 2 jobs, 3 jobs, and the money is never enough. And no one is living a good life that is meaningful life. So I think in the context of Africa, there's need to support small agrarian farming and commercial farming. And small agrarian farmers, it has been shown by research that they actually contribute more to the reserves or food reserves than these commercial farms as well. And then also they can sustain the soil. They know how to sustain the soil, not using toxic. Because also these commercial farms are using a lot of toxic chemicals that cannot sustain us in the future. Land becomes barren. But if you have farmers who are this smallholder farming, they should be supported on how to make the soil continuously regenerate itself. There's need for that kind of research and supporting that kind of farming. So I think I would really want to talk about this push for jobs that human beings are turned into machines and so forth. So now that they are coming with robots, if all of us have been psyched to work and the robots are going to take all these jobs, what is going to happen to the human population? I think the basic income salary can be a good support. But the basic income salary should not be in such a way that you are told that because you get basic income so much, then you should not farm. If you farm, we are going to stop giving you and all that. If the wealth of every country should be distributed fairly and allow people to use their own resources, land, to survive. Like I think Frank said, land means very different things. For example, in Africa, in Zimbabwe, when they were fighting for liberation, they were literally fighting for land, and they even called themselves son of the soil. And in many cultures, the soil is very important. When even a child is born, the Nafal code is put in the soil to connect them with the soil. So when they are born, the Nafal code is buried in the soil to connect them with the soil. So they are part of that soil. So to have this idea also, the Western modernity of cities, that no, everyone must be put in cities. They should have common living conditions. They should have like flats, like going up, the houses that go up, what do you call it? Double stories and all this, what we have here. I think it doesn't work for everybody. So it's also understanding the cultures of people and how those societies can be organizing themselves and be supported in organizing themselves in a way that is that allows for sustainability of their lives. So I think there's a lot of, coming back to pluriverse knowledges, we really need pluriverse knowledges to be have a space so that different kinds of knowledge can help us to revision a new world, a new earth that we can live in a better way.
What about you, Franklin, your thoughts on the next possible steps?
The question raises important issues about space, scale, and time. At the global scale and space, international courts can seriously consider ecological reparations even more attentively. I say even more because international courts have in recent times been taking proactive steps to engage environmental activists on this, on ecological questions, but not ecological reparations. These courts can also consider matters of rent theft from transnational corporations, but also from nations through currency imperialism. For example, at the local, national, and regional levels, as I've kept saying, considering the commoning of land is critical to release those institutions and resources that would ensure that individuals thrive, that common people can be self-employed, not be employed by any other person, but they can employ themselves through creating social enterprises, as suggested by Faith. Research shows that urban agriculture, which is carried out by small-scale farmers, ordinary farmers, actually serves to feed many cities, nations, and regions. Ghana, where I come from, is one of the leading producers of cocoa in the world. Actually, the cocoa industry is based on the work of small-scale farmers. So the question of land is critically important. Finally, on taxing labor, people doing genuine work should be front and center for national, regional, and local governments. The taxes that will be lost from untaxing labor could be replaced, more than replaced, from taxing rent theft and taxing transnational corporations and others. Finally, as a teacher, much attention has been given to the MAGA movement, much less so to MEGA, Make Economics Great Again, the brainchild of the MIT economics couple who won the Nobel Prize for their experimental approach to alleviating global poverty. To understand this mega MAGA, just picture two sorcerers isolated from common people, drawing lines in the ground, in the sand, and reading the tea leaves. And they command much attention, perhaps even fanfare. But their analysis, as accurate as President Trump saying that he would end the war in Ukraine within a short time after taking office, and their predictions are entirely quite questionable. But because what we see depends on how we look, we need transformative alternatives that deepen how we appreciate these questions to inform practice, policy, and politics.
Well, thank you very much. I think we have run out of time now, but we had a really good... Do you want to have one final point?
One final point. There is a view commonly held in the global north that perhaps the global north has a sort of responsibility for the transformation of the global south. My own view is that nothing of such sort is needed. The struggle is for freedom and justice. To paraphrase Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist, everybody has asked this question: what shall we do with them? I have had but one answer from the beginning. Do nothing with us. Your doing stuff has already played the mischief with us. What I ask is not benevolence, not pity, not sympathy, but simply justice.
Well said. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you all for being here today.